My name's Christy Burns, and I do an eclectic number of things. So you could probably guess, you know, about halfway through this, just hearing me talk and listening to the things I do, you could probably guess which of the temperaments I am. I had a Waldorf school enrichment program that I did out of my home for 4 years, and I worked with the temperaments in that situation as a teacher. I'm also a healer. I do herbal healing and naturopathy, and I work with the temperaments in that perspective. So those are the two professional ways that I work with the temperaments. And it's very interesting for me to see how you can work with the temperaments in a classroom situation and also in a healing situation differently and similarly. I've also used temperaments, working with the temperaments in pretty much every aspect of my life. So this is my favorite topic. I really think that a basic understanding of the temperaments and temperament theory can transform anyone's life. And that may sound a bit drastic, but it has completely transformed my life, and it has really helped me in the classroom. It's really helped other parents who have students in my classroom to deal with their children better, and it has really transformed some of my clients, the people that I do healing with. It's really transformed their physical and emotional life. And it's been a really fantastic healing tool. And you'll see that I'm not the only one who thinks that. If you look in your packet that some of the things that I did provide in the packet, you'll see a column. You'll see four different columns. And what I've done is I've divided the columns into the four temperaments. And then I've provided you with correspondences to different plants, different animals, and also correspondences to different systems, because there are so many people who have developed a system of temperaments. It's begun so many years ago. I think even the first people who worked with temperaments didn't write it down. And the theory of working with the temperaments has been around for as long as recorded history has been around. Galen worked with it. Avicenna, who was an Arab healer, worked with it. The Chinese medicine works with five types. Ayurvedic works with three. So this system of typology is very, very widespread. I would have to say the only healing system that doesn't use typology is allopathic medicine, modern allopathic medicine. But every other healing system uses typology in its healing. And if you look at the chart, you'll see there's probably some more modern systems that you might be familiar with. Has anyone taken a Myers-Briggs test? Lots of people did that, and that also has a correspondence with the four temperaments. And you can see how all of these types of tests and different people who've developed, Jung had four temperaments as well. He called them different things, not the sanguine and choleric, but he also had a division of four. And I've put those on the chart so you can compare all the systems. But the reason I made the chart, one of the reasons I made the chart, was just to show people who haven't been exposed to temperament theory before. This is not some far-fetched theory that, you know, that Steiner pulled out of nowhere. This is a solid theory that's been based in history for a long time. It's a solid theory that's been explored by many, many psychologists from different eras. And it's a theory that's been used in many healing systems and many systems of psychology and teaching and even business. So if you haven't, you know, if you're already convinced about temperament theory or the usage of temperaments or how important it is, then you don't need to hear that. But if it's something new to you and it seems a bit far-fetched or you haven't heard about it before, then it's useful to look through the chart and see really how widespread and legitimate it is. So I'll start with, since we're at the Waldorf conference, I'll start with how the temperaments fit in to Waldorf. And Steiner came up with, even though he used the same names for the temperaments that Galen used, that Avicenna used, that many other people used, he had a different way of looking at them and different ways of describing them. But really, they all come to the same conclusion in the end. So I'm going to be introducing different people's ways of looking at them and maybe different terms, but I'm going to stick with the terms that Steiner uses, which are the phlegmatic, sanguine, choleric, and melancholic. And that's also, who knows, by coincidence or fate or whatnot, it's also the same terms that are used in the healing practice that I follow. So these are familiar. But these can be, these can be in different, you can see these in different, used in different ways, interchangeable with other names. If you look on the picture chart that I handed out, on this chart, you can see that some people refer to the phlegmatic as the water type, and some people refer to the sanguine as the air type, and the choleric as the fire type, and the melancholic as an earth type, which, by the way, does not correspond to the earth type in Chinese medicine, if you're familiar with that. So I'm using these terms, but keep an open mind and look on the chart and realize that they also translate into other systems you may know about. Steiner said that the types came about as sort of this meeting point between your essence as a human being, like what you are from all your lives and all that you've been through, this core essence of yourself, combined with your heritage, what came from your relatives before you and that. And he says those two rivers of your essence and your heritage come together and they combine to make your temperament in the same way that, say, blue and yellow combine to make the color green. So he said this is where the source is. And if you look at different people who've talked about temperaments, they all come up with different theories as to where the temperaments came from. But this was what Steiner said. He said this is where your temperament comes from. And he said if you can understand the temperament of a person, you can understand so much about them. And you can use that as a guide in how to teach them. And this is where it comes into the Waldorf education system, is that he would give teachers a guideline for each temperament and how to best reach that child on an educational level and a spiritual level, and how to make their educational experience more enriched because they're being educated in the way that their temperament needs to be educated. So I'm going to take a minute here. He said, I'm going to give you three quotes from him that I'm going to read directly, interspersed here. And this is where he's talking about the source. He said, between the two sources that I've talked about, namely what we bring with us from an earlier life and what our family, ancestors, and race imprint upon us, there's a mediation, he says, something that bears more general characteristics, but at the same time it's capable of being individualized. That which occupies this position between the line of heredity and the line which represents our individuality is expressed by the word temperament. And that's how Steiner describes temperament. But you notice in there that he says it is capable of being individualized. So another thing I like to start every temperament lecture with is to reassure people we're not shuttling everyone you know into four types and saying the world is only four types of people, because that's not true. But you will be astounded when you start to use this system how similar people are. Because I can put everyone, now because I've been working with this for so long, I can put everyone I know and everyone I meet just into a temperament right away. And I find it amazing how similar people of different temperaments are, to the point where I can tell different people, you know, how they would pack their luggage for a trip, and I'll be 90% accurate. And so it's really interesting how accurate this system can be. I like to have some fun with my friends sometimes, you know, and say, oh, this and this and this is what you do, and they'll, how did you know that, you know? And just really obscure things. So on one hand, the temperament theory is so accurate, and you really can put people into four types, and it can just be so specific. But on the other hand, no one is only one temperament. You do have a mixture of all four of them in yourself. And so keep that in mind, that we're not shuttling people into groups and saying you're only this type. That's not what we're doing. The point that Steiner was making, and the point that the other healing systems are making, is not to discriminate, but to work with. And not to say these people are different, so let's separate them, but to show that these people are different, and let's show how they can work together in harmony and how we can work with them. So a lot of people have this stereotype that when you're working with types, you're separating. You are stereotyping. You are creating a rigid system. But it's not that intention. You need to look at types in a different way. Types are for the purpose of harmonizing. These types, if you look at the elements that go into them, which is the different systems of the body or the different elements. What you're looking at is you're combining these all to make a unified being, to make a unified universe. And so you can't just take out one type and our world would still be here. You need all of these types. You need them unified. You need them in harmony. So that's an important thing to remember when you go into temperament. I'm going to give another quote from Steiner because it goes into what I'm going to talk about here, why you would use the temperaments or how to use them once you learn about them. Steiner was concerned a lot initially with using them in education. And he said, now if we know all of this about the temperaments, we can also learn to apply it. Particularly, it must be of interest to learn how we can handle the temperaments pedagogically in childhood. He said, for in education, the kind of temperament must be carefully observed. With children, it's especially important to be able to guide and to direct the developing temperament. But later, he said, and this is important because you're probably a lot of you coming here for your children, but apply this to yourselves too because you can really help yourselves heal. He said, later, it's also still important for anyone in self-education. For the person who wishes to train himself, it is invaluable that he observe what is expressed in his temperament. So I want you, as you're listening to this about the temperaments, if you came here to learn something about your child or how to educate your child, open your mind a little more and use this in other ways too. Because if you can understand the concept with your child and how to use the temperaments with your child, you can apply it to everything else. And here's some ways that you can use it. One way is, and some of these are ways that you can use it, and some of these ways are ways that as a universal humankind we can use it. So the first one is more universal. I think that when temperaments are used, it creates more of a path or more of an opportunity. It invites us to accept and harmonize and tolerate other people. Because when we're taught, oh, there's four different types and that's normal, and oh, they work together, and look how beautiful each of these qualities for the four types are, that invites us as human beings to accept. It invites us to tolerate. So imagine if from childhood we're taught this theory in some subtle way, and as we grow, we're taught more about it. It's inviting us into a different way of looking at the world. Rather than the alternate, there's many alternates, but there is one alternate that a lot of people have gotten into, which is us and them. We're this type. We're Waldorf parents and you're not. Well, we're Christians and you're not. We're college educated and you're not. Or I don't know, whatever people may say, but there's always an us and them thing going on. And especially in the political conflicts lately, there's a lot of conflict between the Middle East and the United States, and both sides are saying, we're right, we're right. And there's just this idea that one person's right. And so I really think that the temperament theory, if it was really into people and they really were looking at it, it could create a lot of acceptance, harmony, and tolerance. The other two things, this sort of goes together, is when you're learning about the temperaments, you can use it to identify your strengths and your weaknesses, and it gives you a roadmap to go on. It gives you an idea of what to expect in your own life. And you can also identify the strengths and weaknesses of the people you know, of your children. And this isn't a bad thing. Some people may say, well, why do I want to know that this is my weakness? If I knew this was my weakness, if I didn't know it was my weakness, maybe I would just try it anyway and I'd be good at it. And that's one way to look at it. But it's also very good to know, well, what do you tend to do well or not tend to do well? What do you tend to, what is your style of learning? For instance, I'll just give an example that comes to mind. I'm of the sanguine temperament, and I learned very early on that I don't do very well with one task, that I get bored easily, that I want to do something else, that I don't find it stimulating enough. And so I learned early on that I'm not going to go into a job where I go in 9 to 5. That's not going to work for me. And maybe that would work for another sanguine if they found a job that was ideal for them. But for me, I found, it works really well in my life to just have these different things that I do and rotate them. That just works so well for me. So I can have a really effective productivity in my work life by working with my strengths and weaknesses. Whereas if I get into a situation where I'm doing a 9-to-5 sort of job, my productivity goes down. And so this is one way you can learn to deal with the strengths and weaknesses that are in the temperaments. So if you know them, that'll help you in your work life, your education, different things like that. The fourth thing is it can help you understand and forgive and not take things personally. And this is sort of an interpersonal relationship issue. If different people have different ways of communicating in the temperaments, and different people have ways of expressing themselves and experiencing life, then it's obvious that you're going to get people in conflict. For instance, one person, typical of the choleric temperament, would react very quickly and strongly to situations. If it's an angry situation, they may get angry very quickly and very firmly. And that may hurt someone of the phlegmatic temperament who reacts very slowly and not very deeply to things. So that they may just be so offended by that. But if they can understand, oh, you know, this is just how the choleric temperament is. It's not personal against me. And that's the key here, is it's not about you. It's not personal against you. When you're having these interpersonal conflicts, I've discovered that so many of the interpersonal conflicts between spouses, between teacher and student, between parent and student, parent and child, so many of these conflicts that rub people the wrong way, that get people up in arms at each other, so many of them are just simply you not understanding the other person's language or not understanding how the other person deals with life. And so imagine how easy it would be if now you can go out of here and just sort of instantly forgive and instantly accept every choleric person you know for their angry outbursts at you. Because you know that as a choleric person, they're just going to yell at you for like 2 minutes and then they're going to probably, you know, forget about it or something the next day. And if you know that, then you don't have to participate. You can just sort of let them talk and, you know, oh, okay. And then go on with it. And they're happy and you're happy and you don't have to take it personally and you don't have to make that cause a rift in your relationship. Does that make any sense? It's sort of an understanding, realizing it's not personal against you. It's just the way they are. And another example would be like the sanguine temperament being very flighty. They have a tendency to be like a butterfly. So I'm going to stick with the topic of conversations here just to make it congruent. So if you're having a conversation with a sanguine person, they may look around a bit. You know, they may not be focused on you. And some people may think, well, that person's not very interested in me. You know, she's not really focusing on me very well. And so you may decide, well, I don't want to pursue this friendship, or she's being a little bit rude. But if you realize this is just a sanguine person, they're like that. You know, they're not going to focus on you like that. And then if you realize that, then it becomes a non-issue. You see how that works? And then if we go into, like, the communication of the phlegmatic, and I've had friends of all these types and had to deal with all these issues. A phlegmatic temperament would be somebody who would be more disinterested in things around them, not very enthusiastic in their response. So friends like that, you might be having a conversation with them, and they really wouldn't be that responsive. They wouldn't add much to the conversation. Maybe they would enjoy listening to you more than adding to the conversation. And you may assume, well, this person's not interested in what I'm saying. Or, you know, maybe this person doesn't like me very much. Or this isn't much of a friendship, they don't talk much or something. I mean, you just may make all these assumptions, whereas from their end, they're fine. They may think you talk too much if you're sanguine and they're phlegmatic. I mean, they may have issues too for you, you know. But, you know, if you can just accept, oh, you know, I have a friend who's of the phlegmatic personality, and we really like each other. I think a lot of our friendship has been based in the fact that we were very close when our children were very young. And we really don't have a lot in common. But when we get together, we'll just sort of weed her garden together. Or we'll do some canning together. And so this is sort of our relationship is sort of based in her world. I don't bring in a lot of butterfly conversation and this and that. She likes listening to my stories sometimes. And that entertains her. but we just found our own way to relate. But I used to think in the beginning of the relationship that she didn't like me at all, because she wouldn't really initiate calling me. And it turned out I was one of her favorite friends. But just as a phlegmatic, she doesn't sit there and say, oh, I'm going to pick up the phone. She's like, oh, I'm just going to wait for the phone to ring. You know, so it's a different way of looking at life. And then the melancholic is sometimes, for me, it's one of the most difficult ones to relate to, but the irony is that all of my best friends are melancholics for some reason. And I mean, it works really well together because it's a balancing effect, like the ones on this side, you know, it balances, but it can also cause conflict. But one of the things that it took me a long time to understand with the melancholic personality was their slow response to. And so in a conversation, if you're chattering away like a sanguine, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, they're not following you. And so they may respond to something you said before, like three sentences before, and you end up getting this disjointed conversation. Or you may say something that offends them, and it takes a long time for them to respond to that, so you don't realize right away. So if I deal with a melancholic temperament, my relationships have improved with this type of temperament 600, 1,000% since I started slowing down my conversation with them and respecting that they just don't want to be overloaded, and also looking for cues as to how I'm doing with them and waiting for those cues to come. So if I have a melancholic friend or a friend of the melancholic temperament, I'll maybe introduce one or two new topics at a time, and then I'll give it a week to see if they absorbed it or not. Because otherwise, you know, maybe they got offended, and it'll take them a while, too, to react. So that might be the kind of person who you thought you were doing just fine with them, and 6 weeks from now, they all of a sudden get mad and just don't want to talk to you anymore. And that's because it took them 6 weeks to really process that. And so if you can understand, this is what I'm talking about with understanding, forgiving, not taking things personally with the temperaments. And it's the same, you can apply this to children, too. And I'll go into that. You can communicate better, and I think I already touched on that, because if you understand how the temperament communicates, then you can either change your communication a little bit, meet them partway, or you can at least understand how they're communicating so you're not confused. And this works with children, for instance. Steiner gave some wonderful tips on how to communicate with each child in an educational environment. He said that the choleric, the reason I wrote these on the board is because they're not in the packet, so I'd like you to add them to your chart. There's no extra ones, but if you put your list on the email and put no packet, I can send that with the other by email. This chart here, yeah, I find it really useful. A lot of people have told me it was useful for them to like post on the refrigerator or something. And so you can add Steiner's remarks here, because I just didn't include them in this chart, because this chart I made for something else and I haven't changed it yet. It was actually a graphic designer made it. That's why I didn't change it, because I'd have to go into that program and change it. But Steiner defined the choleric temperament as being ruled by the ego, and the element in the body that rules them is the blood. And so he said in a classroom situation or in a teaching situation with a choleric temperament, the way you communicate with them best is they do really well with two different things. They do really well with respect and with people they can respect and people who look like they know what they're doing, and this feeling of confidence from their teacher or parent. So if you... And I can see this in my own house. I'm so lucky, I have three of the temperaments in my house. So I get to learn on a daily basis all these little, you know, interactions. And it's so true of my choleric daughter that if I don't approach her in a very confident, I know what I'm talking about way, she'll find a loophole in what I'm saying. Because that's how they accept you. You know, they're ruled by the ego element, and they know what they want out of life. They're very direct. They're very confident themselves. And if you don't present yourself in their language, they won't listen, and they won't respect what you're saying, and they won't want to learn from you. And it doesn't have to be firm. I mean, you don't have to come and approach them in an aggressive way. I'm talking about confidence, like, don't come to a choleric and say, well, what do you think about this? Would you like to do this now? You know, bring it to them and say, how about we do this now? Or I invite you to do this now. Something more direct. They want direct, and say it with a little confidence. You know, not like, well, do you like this? Is this nice? Would you like to do this? They don't go for that. You know, they want to see that you're confident, that you're presenting that to them in a confident manner. And with the sanguine child, you're going to have a hard time getting them to concentrate on one thing. And a lot of, I remember when I was in school, one of the things that came back on my report card a lot was I'm inconsistent. And I was really bothered by that. I'm inconsistent. I'm not inconsistent. Because I was living in my sanguine world, and my sanguine world, I was very consistent. I consistently did 10 different things. You know, I was consistent. And so they're very comfortable doing many different things, and they like a variety of things to keep them amused. So the best way to communicate with a sanguine child, and they're ruled by the astral body, the best way to communicate with them is to provide them in a loving way with just so many wonderful things and so many opportunities and so many ideas, and just let them know that you're inviting them and you're welcoming them to do these things, and that that's okay. Let them know that that is okay, because a lot of people will tell a sanguine child, that's not okay, you need to focus. You know, you need to practice your instrument for a half hour. You know, you need to focus, what's wrong with you? Well, maybe a sanguine child wants to practice their instrument for 10 minutes, go do something else and come back and practice for another 10 minutes. You know, that's okay. They learn in a different way. And if you can get a sanguine child to live in the moment, then you've got them, you've really got them educated well, because they can focus in that 10 minutes on their instrument, they can go do something else for 10 minutes, go do something else for 10 minutes, and if they're focusing in each of those 10 minutes or each of those half hours, they're being educated very well. But if you're forcing them to focus on one thing for an hour at a time, you've lost them, and you're not going to be communicating with them or educating them. The melancholic child tends to be melancholic, you know, a bit morose. Sometimes you may think they're a bit depressed. You know, they may not necessarily complain so much, but they just, you know, they're not so enthusiastic about everything. You say, do you want to do this? Not really. You know, how about we go to here? I don't really want to go. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, they just are not that, you know, they're just a little bit sad and, you know, melancholic, and they're so happy like that. They're really happy in that situation. That's as a child. I have a few adult friends that are melancholic, and one of them is very in touch with their feelings, and they actually communicated to me many times, you know, how are you doing today, this or that? Oh, I'm just so sad today, and I'm enjoying it so much. You know, they really enjoy being sad, and I find it the most phenomenal thing, because as a sanguine, I hate being sad. You know, I love being joyful, and every time I'm sad, I just feel so terrible about it, you know? But it's wonderful. They really are comfortable with that melancholy. And so to teach a melancholic child and communicate with them and to keep them a little bit more motivated and a little bit more chipper about learning and education and communication, it's good to be able to focus their melancholy outside of themselves rather than in themselves. So sharing with them stories about other people who overcame difficult things, stories of heroes, you know, that you could share stories with them. If you yourself have been through something difficult in your life and learned a lesson from it, if you share that with them, oh, they love that. They love those stories, and they just eat it up, and they gain so much respect for you, because to them, that is how the world is. And if you can direct then their melancholy outside of themselves more in that way, through stories, through showing them, oh, look at this person who's suffering, let's help them, or let's think about that for a while, then that helps them because it directs it out of themselves. Otherwise, they just end up being melancholy in themselves all the time and sitting around, you know, maybe unmotivated, maybe getting depressed. But if you can teach them to get that, you know, get that out and place that melancholy somewhere else, then that's really good for them, and that'll help their education and the communication along. And you'll find a lot of the melancholic types are they like to serve people and help people. And they're the types who also, if they find someone in need, they just, oh, really? You need my help? You know, they're like so excited about helping someone else because I think they themselves feel so happy that they've been able to get that melancholy out of themselves and place it somewhere else. The phlegmatic child, which is ruled by the etheric element, the etheric body and the glandular system of the body, is, you know, they're really not inner motivated. They're just these peaceful, sort of going with the flow people, and they're quiet, maybe just sitting there, maybe doing things, but just, they're the kind of person where you initially look at them and you think, you know, they're not doing anything. Or maybe teachers at school will think they're a little slow. But they're really not. They're just very relaxed, living in the now, phlegmatic personalities. And, you know, I always say these are the happiest ones. You know, I envy them because they live in the now. They're just, you know, just happy. They're calm about what goes on around them. They don't have these all these things they want to do. They don't have a lot of conflicting emotions or this or that. They're just living in the now. They're just here. They're just, you know, and that bothers a lot of people, though. They have, a lot of people want to poke them. You know, have you ever met someone like that and you just want to poke them? You're like, move, you know, or even emotionally or even in conversation, you know, you just want to, yeah, it's like, come on, you know, get going, you know. And so a lot of people are bothered by that, you know. But don't let it bother you. And if you have a child like that, don't let it worry you. The best way to educate them is just to provide them with a lot of stimulating environment, a lot of friends that have interests and maybe are of different personalities, because they're going to be externally stimulated. And so you're going to get the phlegmatic, you're going to sort of wake up the potential in the phlegmatic child by from the outside. It's some of these people around them and environment around them is going to rub off on them. And so if they have a best friend who does soccer, they may decide to go to soccer practice for a while with that friend. Or if they have a friend who sits around reading a lot, that friend may be picking up a book, so they may be sitting beside them and going, oh, I'll pick up a book too. You know, and so just best way to educate them is just to have things happening around them. Because if you put a phlegmatic child in a quiet environment, or if they're an only child and they're just around the house and there's really not that much around, they'll just sit there. And they're happy just sitting there. There's no problem with them just sitting there. It really bothers other people, but they're really happy about it. The last thing, and I'm going to include this, even though this is a Waldorf conference and we're looking how to deal with the temperaments on a personality level, I'm going to include a little bit at the end about healing, because another way you can use the temperaments system is to heal disease. And the system of anthroposophy uses the temperaments to heal disease. And you can, and many other systems use the four temperaments to heal disease. And this can help you if your child has a flu or a cold, or I'm trying to think, they have anxiety, they have maybe problems with eczema, different problems. You can help, you can heal them better if you know their temperament and if you know the temperament of their disease. And that's where the charts that are here will help you, and the other charts that I was going to send will help you. I think I went through this before at the beginning, but I'll go through it quickly again. I've used the temperaments in my healing, in my personal relationships, in public interactions with people. Like, I'll go shopping sometimes and I'll encounter different temperaments that maybe initially go, whoa, why'd that sales clerk say that, you know? And if I can just put it in, you know, this temperament theory, I can realize what's going on there. In business, I've used it in business interactions. And this is an interesting example. A few days ago, I had an email, and I've made it very clear to people that for the past 2 weeks, I've been traveling around, and I'm not able to answer emails right away. And so I have a little autoresponder that says that. And most people are accepting of that. But I had somebody write me an email, and I pegged them from point one as a choleric, just from a few things they said. And I'm like, this person's not going to sit around and wait for me to get back to my office. And it was an important enough business interaction that I said, you know, I'm just going to make a little extra effort for this person, knowing their temperament. They're going to be sitting at home, checking their email every hour to see if I wrote them back. And I just made an extra effort for them, knowing that they would be suffering and it would be, you know, hurting our relationship for me not to make an extra effort to answer back. So even though I had to go find the computer and, you know, make some extra effort, I did it, And so this is how I can help my business, you know, my business interactions by knowing the temperaments. And then in teaching, of course, and then in mothering, definitely we can all use this with our children because it helps you understand. Like I said, I have three of the temperaments in my house, and I even discipline them differently. And the funny thing is they don't complain about it. You know, they're just so happy with the whole system that they don't notice that I'm disciplining one different than the other. They're just, you know, as long as it's fair or as long as they feel everybody's getting what they deserve, you know. So now that I've talked about how you can use it and just given a few examples, I'm going to go into how you can identify each of the four temperaments. And I'm going to talk about it on a psychological level and a physical level. How many people in here think they have a pretty good handle how to identify the temperaments already? Teacher's pet. So that's good. That's the response I was looking for, because I don't want to like over talk about something if you already know about it, because I've already given so many examples. But I'm going to start with the chart here. Or not the chart, I guess this would be called a poster or illustration. This is what I'm going to start with as a basis. And the way that I learned about the temperaments and how to identify each of the four types was I started with a basic knowledge and a vague idea of what they were like. And then I built on that. And then I started making lists. And I think I had a little bit too much fun with it. I had a notebook where I would have phlegmatic, choleric, melancholic, and I would write things that they did. And that was actually pretty helpful for me. And I wouldn't only write things from my own experience. I started my charts actually with charts like I have here. Like I've given you a chart that says sanguine, choleric, melancholic, phlegmatic, and then under each of those are correspondences with the Jung system, with the system of Myers-Briggs, with correspondences to cartoon characters, to animals, to flowers, to colors. Just reading down these columns, all of a sudden the image is going to come alive in your mind because you'll get an idea. And so I started with these columns that I made actually evolved over, say, 6 or 8 years. But when I first started the column, I think it was only 10 things. But even those 10 things helped me. So if you can start with this list of, I don't know, 40 things, and just read through each column, it's almost like this picture is being painted in front of your eyes. And you think, sanguine, oh, and then you start reading down the column. They're related to the humor of the blood, to the Chinese element of wood, to the air and the wind, to the age of childhood, to the animal of the monkey or birds, to the archetype of the pioneer, to the biblical figure of Peter, Charlie Brown figure of Snoopy, you know, all these things. You know, you keep reading down this chart, and as you read, you go, oh, okay, I'm starting to get it. You know, and you start to get this image of what the sanguine personality is like. And so if you start with that and then add to it with your own notes, that's how you're going to really get a handle on this. But I'm going to start you with this chart. And my favorite way of identifying the temperaments is by using Winnie the Pooh, just because it's so accessible. And everyone knows about Winnie the Pooh in almost every culture now. And it's pretty, Milne, who did the Winnie the Pooh, I haven't done a lot of research on him, but I'm going to now. I think he really must have identified, he must have known a lot about the types, the four types, because his characters in the books are just classic. And he also came from an era just on the verge that was sort of ending. It was very, very popular for writers and playwrights to integrate the types into their plays. And if you read Shakespeare, he has many types. You know, he'll even directly refer to melancholic, sanguine, whatever. And so much literature. I have a course that I teach on the temperaments, and I provide a bunch of examples from literature. And there's so much literature on that really directly refers to the types. So at one time, this was almost common knowledge. This was something that was so commonly known among people and so commonly referred to that people in literature were writing about it, and people were laughing about it and saying, oh yeah, we know that type, we know that type. And so In Winnie the Pooh, he also divides his characters into the four types. And if we start with the phlegmatic is like Eeyore. They're switched, aren't they? I just realized that, just this moment. Okay, yeah, that's wrong. I'm going to write it up here the right way. Oh, okay, yeah, that's wrong, though, because Eeyore is melancholic. See, you guys know more than you said. Let me just write it under that. Yeah, that's wrong. And there's another place on the chart that's wrong, too. I'm going to mention that. Yeah, this is Eeyore. And this is Winnie the Pooh. And then while we're doing corrections here, if you go down the chart, the four-column chart, let's see where it says, I have them in alphabetical order, and it says expression. You have to switch both of the columns. Sanguine is joy, and choleric is anger. It's in expression. It's in the four-column chart, and it's under expression, and you can find expression because it's in alphabetical order. And then, so you switch the first two columns, and you switch the second two column or the second set of columns. You have to switch sorrow and fear around. The melancholic is fear, and the phlegmatic is sorrow. So those got switched. And, you know, they can apply to the other one, too, but that's more accurate is to put it like that. Okay, So now we'll do it correctly. The phlegmatic is represented in Winnie the Pooh by Winnie the Pooh himself. And so if you think of all the things that he was, then you can start to get a vision of what the phlegmatic person is like. And a really good way to define all of the actions of the phlegmatic is by the second thing I have here, where it says social interaction. And it says social interaction, but I can really redefine this as life interaction. Because the phlegmatic, which is the Winnie the Pooh type, reacts to things and people in a slow but shallow way. And so, not shallow meaning they don't have a mind or they're a shallow person, shallow meaning not this intense, deep interaction. Just very shallow, very calm, very not a lot of strength or depth to it. And it's slow. So they'll react to things slowly. And you can apply this to everything the phlegmatic does. So if you can remember these two things about that personality, you can identify that in a lot of people. And what I try to encourage people to do, is to keep some of these basic underlying things in mind when they're identifying the personality types, because you can apply it to so many things. So for instance, if you're in a conversation and someone reacts in a slow but shallow way, that's phlegmatic. If you're in a classroom situation and they're reacting in a slow but shallow way, that could be phlegmatic. I usually cross-reference a bunch of things they're doing to really figure them out. But it's good if you can apply this phraseology to many things. And you can also apply it to the way they eat. It says the phlegmatics are the most deliberate. No, it is. You know, this is switched too, I think. Because, yeah, this is switched. At the restaurant is switched too. So the phlegmatics are actually more the picky eaters. And it takes them just a long time to make up their mind. And when it arrives, they just sit there and savor it. You know, they just sit there and eat it very slowly. And so savoring it. And so that goes along with the slow but shallow. You know, they're slowly picking out things and just slowly eating it. So if we go on to the melancholic type, that corresponds to Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh. And he's pretty easy to recognize. And you can recognize him in different people. And one way I used to figure out what types people were initially was I would try to figure out which character they were most like. And they're not going to be exactly like one of the characters, but they'll have more of one element. And then you can go and cross-reference it with different things and figure out, oh yeah, they really are more of the melancholic temperament. And so Eeyore and the melancholic types, they have a slow but deep response to things. And this is key. It's slow, but it's very deep. And I'll give you an example in education. My son, who's of the melancholic temperament, when you first introduce him to a new idea, you think that he wasn't listening, or you think that he doesn't get it, or you think that he's not interested. And he'll just sit there. And even his teachers, I have to sort of warn them ahead of time. I have to say, don't worry if he doesn't participate. Don't worry if he's just sitting there for a couple weeks. Just wait, you know, because something will happen. And they have appreciated this information from me, because when I forgot to tell one of the teachers, she came to me and she said, is he okay? He's just sitting there. He's not participating. He's not enthusiastic. He's not doing anything. That's because he is slowly absorbing things. He's getting ready. And then once he's absorbed it, I tell you, that response is deep. Because he, for instance, the way he learned knitting, he sat and watched me knit for about 3 weeks. Mommy, can I just sit next to you while you're knitting? Okay. All right, he'd just sit there. Can I hold the yarn for you? Okay, and he'd hold the yarn, you know. Just this process. And then all of a sudden, after 3 weeks, he said, will you teach me how to knit? And at the time, he was only six. And so I'm thinking, I don't feel like teaching a six-year-old to knit today. You know, because it's just this process of the needles and getting them all mixed up and the coordination. And I just sort of wasn't in the mood that day. But then my mothering voice came and said, your son's come to you and asked you how to knit. This is an opening. You have to take it. So I said, okay, I'll teach you how to knit. And he just picked up those needles and knitted. I didn't even have to teach him. You know, because the response was slow but deep. And it's the same way he learned how to read, how he learned how to do math, how he learned how to do everything. It was just like, you don't think he's listening, then all of a sudden, he's doing it. And a lot of melancholics are like this. And so in educational-wise, it just takes patience. And just trust that they're listening. Trust that they're getting it. Because they are. And don't put pressure on them to participate or throw it back to you right away. Don't tell a melancholic, okay, here's it. Here's the stuff I'm teaching you. Now tell me, what did you understand from that? You know, they don't like that pressure. Let them have a few days to absorb it before you ask them what they understood. Or even better yet, give them the information and then wait for them to choose to give it back to you. And so if you know that a child's of a melancholic temperament, then you can see how you would be much more gentle with them to treat them according to their temperament. Because if you treated them in a more traditional manner, like, okay, here's the concept, feed it back to me, where's your performance, let's see what you did today based on what you did yesterday. This is just too much for a melancholic child to deal with. And, you know, these children will be put in situations that are not good for them to deal with, and they'll deal somehow. But we're talking here about an ideal educational situation, where you as a teacher are getting the best you can out of your students, where your classroom is as calm as it can be, where your house is as calm as it can be. So we go then to the choleric child or person, and they're more like Rabbit in the Winnie the Pooh. And you know Rabbit, he always knew what he wanted. He knew how to say it, and he was very intelligent. He had it figured out how to garden. He had all his carrots in a row, all the lettuce in a row. And he knew what he was doing. And he expected everyone else in the woods to know what he was doing too and to follow his rules. And he expected everyone to listen to him. And this was his personality. And this is the choleric person. And another way of looking at a choleric child or person is a lot of the choleric children, when they're children, a lot of them are princesses. You know, they're like that kind of, as girls, they may be like, they want to be treated like a princess. You know, they want the attention. They are there, and they expect to be the leader sometimes. And they're just firm, they're active, they're enthusiastic. But the most interesting thing and defining quality in the choleric is their strong will and their decisiveness in things. You can define a choleric just by their lack of faltering. They don't falter. They may, every once in a while, because nobody's just a choleric. But a choleric person is the person who knows what they want, decides quickly and firmly. And this is defined where it says in their social interaction, which is their life interaction, they have a quick and strong lasting response. So if you ask a choleric something, they'll answer you quickly, and it's a strong, long-lasting response. And this often will confuse teachers or parents, because if you have a four-year-old who says, I want this, and this is how I'm going to do it, and then they stand there, you'll think, there's no way a four-year-old could know what they want. You know, I had my choleric child was more confident and defined about her life than I was. And that I couldn't understand that. So I didn't understand her for a while because I couldn't understand how she would know more about her life and be more in identification with herself than I was. I'm sitting here going, well, I'm, you know, 30-some years old, and I don't know some of the answers to these questions, so how can she know? So, but they do. They really know. So if you have a choleric child in your classroom or you have one in your home, they really do know what they want, and you have to trust them on that. Don't second-guess them and don't tell them, well, why don't you think about it for a while? Or, you know, why don't you try this instead? They know already. They were born knowing. And so you have to trust that in them. Yeah, this is a good question. And the way with the choleric you do that is you keep them busy with other challenges. Because the choleric is energetic. They need challenge. They like to challenge. They like to define things. And if you don't keep them challenged, then they're going to find challenge in other situations. So like a bored choleric will sit around and argue, will sit around and find trouble to make, will try to become the boss of the house, will manipulate the parents. But
yeah, I mean, it's amazing, this temperament, because I have a choleric daughter who's 3, and I didn't have any, I just go head, I'm choleric, and so I'm head to head.
Like, yeah, no. and you don't want to deal with it that way, yeah.
No, what you, yeah. My mom dealt with it, but, you know, my daughter says, I will not, I'm going to walk. And my mom has this whole thing, like, you're not going to walk. You're going to get into the stroller and point at all of the flowers that you know the names of.
Yeah, so she's redirecting that energy in some way.
It's like, you know, you have to be confident and bossy kind of dealing with this child who's pig-headed and, you know, knows exactly what they want to do.
Right.
But at this, and then challenging. And my mom and my daughter's like, whoa, I don't know. She gets into the stroller, so rosemary, lavender, you know,
right,
walking down the street. It's like a challenge that she could rise to aside from fighting.
And this is the way you do it. And, you know, you were saying you have to be sort of bossy and whatever with them, but that's the trick with choleric, is that, you know, you feel that you have to be bossy and, you know, almost mean with them in some ways, otherwise they won't listen. But you really have to... You really have to walk that fine line between bossiness and assertiveness, because assertiveness is really the best way with them, but it's so hard for some people to define what's bossy and what's assertive. And assertiveness with the choleric is just firm repetition. So it doesn't have to be in a challenging way, like you're not going to, or I'm not allowing that. Just, well, we're going to do this now, or let's do this now, or we're going here now, and just repeating it over and over in a gentle way. Repetition works wonders with the choleric. Just firm repetition, because that shows them that you're not being mean to them. You're just being annoying. And you're not, and you're not trying to hurt them. You're just repeating things gently. And it also shows them that you're confident, because you have to be confident if you've said it 60 times. And it shows them that you know what you want, because you've said it, and you've said it again and again. And so repetition works really well if you're talking about discipline. And just redirecting. Redirecting, you know, works. Now, sometimes, you know, you're going to get in conflict, and you won't, and these methods won't work, and that's just life. Sometimes it doesn't work. But it works so much of the time, this redirection and just being assertive and repetitive. And the redirection has to be towards something that interests them. Because choleric children, like... I know some of my relatives have tried to redirect her by watching TV. That is just not amusing to her. She wants something challenging. She wants to do something that entertains her or that challenges her in some way. So if somebody wants to sort of not deal with her, why don't you just go watch this program? She'll look at you and go, I don't want to watch no program. I don't, you know, she doesn't want that. So you do have to redirect them in a challenging way. They need to be challenged.
I was going to mention my
Yeah, they like that. Yeah, they like the. I mean, you don't want to encourage too much competitiveness, but they like it. So you can play on that with, like, if they're competing with themselves. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's nice. And the other thing they like is, like giving a challenge to them, like not necessarily competing, but saying, "I wonder if you can do that." Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if you could do that this way. And then they'll go, "Oh, I can." Mm-hmm. Yeah, they rise to that. And then the sanguine child is more like Tigger. And that's, I don't know, I think, maybe because I'm sanguine, I think the sanguine's the easiest to define. Actually, I think the sanguine and the phlegmatic are the easiest to define, because the phlegmatic just sits there, and so that's pretty easy to define. And then the sanguine is always going around like a butterfly, so that seems pretty easy to me. And like Tigger, they're always bouncing around, you know, and everything. And they also have a quick and superficial excitability in their reactions to things. So a sanguine will just react just so quickly. But the nice thing about it is it's very superficial. And that can be good and bad. If you're getting in an argument with them, it's a good thing. Because a sanguine person could just be mad 1 minute and then they'll forget about it 6 minutes later. You can actually go to a sanguine person and apologize to them about something and they'll say to you, "What are you apologizing about? Huh?" They don't get it. Because they live in this moment, they've reacted quickly, it's gone. That was in a past life. You know, so if you want to talk to them, you have to talk to them now, because that's where they are, they're here. If you try to talk to them about something that happened 5 days ago, that's just not real anymore. And so they're all over the place. Now, you can balance all of these personalities. I'm telling you, like, the exaggerated part of the personality. But in a child, they're often exaggerated. And the other thing about the quick and superficial, a lot of times people will criticize a sanguine for... it's interesting, when I was doing research on temperaments, there was one particular book where the man described all of the types, and he described them all in this really negative way, and then when he got to the melancholic type, it was just so positive. And it was the funniest thing. I said, you know, I wonder who wrote this book, you know? But he just really went down hard on the sanguines. He's like, yeah, you can't trust them as friends. They're all over the board. They never know what they want. You know, and this could happen. Okay, this is a negative aspect of that personality. But it actually doesn't have to be that way. It can also be looked at in a positive light. And when I teach about the temperaments, I try to tell the parents and teachers to focus on the positive aspect of the temperaments. So instead of saying you're all over the board and you don't know what you want, say they're a butterfly. They have many varied interests. So you're saying the same thing, but you are saying it in a positive way that encourages growth and invites them to work on that rather than a negative way that breaks them down. So like a choleric person, you can say, well, that choleric person is just so obstinate. But you could also just say, they have a really strong will. I admire that about them. And a melancholic, you can just say, you know, they're just always depressed about something, always in their own world thinking about some depressing thought. Or you can just say, this person is very deep and thoughtful. And I admire that about them. And a lot of artists and songwriters and whatnot can be of the melancholic temperament. And the phlegmatic person, you could, you know, a lot of people really give the phlegmatic a hard time. Boy, they're just so slow. They're just sitting there. But I admire them so much. They live in the now. They are these, you know, ethereal beings. And that's a wonderful thing about them. So sort of trying to bring what the temperaments are alive, you know, personality-wise. Does that give me a show of hands? How many people feel that they have a feel of the temperaments more than they did 15 minutes ago? Good. Yes. Okay.
How do you deal when you have different temperaments in your children, and one is very choleric and may try to maybe be the leader for all of them, but maybe it's, how do you help that interaction?
Okay, I have that. Yeah, I have that issue in my house because I have three of them, three different temperaments, and of course I match temperaments with one of them, so I favor her. She's, you know, like I started out, you know, my relationships with the children where, you know, she was always right, you know. But, you know, you get out of that. What I did was, and I don't know if this is the way you would all choose to do this, But I actually taught my children about the temperaments. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to encourage too much competitiveness, but they like it, so you can play on that with, like, if they're competing with themselves. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's nice. And the other thing they like is, like, giving a challenge to them. Like, not necessarily competing, but saying, I wonder if you can do that. Yeah, I wonder if you could do that this way. And then they'll go, oh, I can. You know, they rise to that. And then the sanguine child is more like Tigger. And that's, I don't know, I think, maybe because I'm sanguine, I think the sanguine's the easiest to define. Actually, I think the sanguine and the phlegmatic are the easiest to define, because the phlegmatic just sits there, and so that's pretty easy to define. And then the sanguine is always going around like a butterfly, so that seems pretty easy to me. And like Tigger, they're always bouncing around, you know, and everything. And they also have a quick and superficial excitability in their reactions to things. So a sanguine will just react just so quickly. But the nice thing about it is it's very superficial. And that can be good and bad. If you're getting in an argument with them, it's a good thing. Because a sanguine person could just be mad 1 minute and then they'll forget about it 6 minutes later. You can actually go to a sanguine person and apologize to them about something and they'll say to you, what are you apologizing about? Huh? They don't get it. Because they live in this moment, they've reacted quickly, it's gone. That was in a past life. You know, so if you want to talk to them, you have to talk to them now, because that's where they are, they're here. If you try to talk to them about something that happened 5 days ago, that's just not real anymore. And so they're all over the place. Now, you can balance all of these personalities. I'm telling you, like, the exaggerated part of the personality. But in a child, they're often exaggerated. And the other thing about the quick and superficial, a lot of times people will criticize a sanguine for... it's interesting, when I was doing research on temperaments, there was one particular book where the man described all of the types, and he described them all in this really negative way, and then when he got to the melancholic type, it was just so positive. And it was the funniest thing. I said, you know, I wonder who wrote this book, you know? But he just really went down hard on the sanguines. He's like, yeah, you can't trust them as friends. They're all over the board. They never know what they want. You know, and this could happen. Okay, this is a negative aspect of that personality. But it actually doesn't have to be that way. It can also be looked at in a positive light. And when I teach about the temperaments, I try to tell the parents and teachers to focus on the positive aspect of the temperaments. So instead of saying you're all over the board and you don't know what you want, say they're a butterfly. They have many varied interests. So you're saying the same thing, but you are saying it in a positive way that encourages growth and invites them to work on that rather than a negative way that breaks them down. So like a choleric person, you can say, well, that choleric person is just so obstinate. But you could also just say, they have a really strong will. I admire that about them. And a melancholic, you can just say, you know, they're just always depressed about something, always in their own world thinking about some depressing thought. Or you can just say, this person is very deep and thoughtful. And I admire that about them. And a lot of artists and songwriters and whatnot can be of the melancholic temperament. And the phlegmatic person, you could, you know, a lot of people really give the phlegmatic a hard time. Boy, they're just so slow. They're just sitting there. But I admire them so much. They live in the now. They are these, you know, ethereal beings. And that's a wonderful thing about them. So sort of trying to bring what the temperaments are alive, you know, personality-wise. Does that, give me a show of hands, how many people feel that they have a feel of the temperaments more than they did 15 minutes ago? Good. Yes. Okay.
How do you deal when you have different temperaments in your children, and one is very choleric and may try to maybe be the leader for all of them, but maybe it's, how do you help that interaction?
Okay, I have that. Yeah, I have that issue in my house because I have three of them, three different temperaments, and of course, I match temperaments with one of them, so I favor her. She's, you know, like I started out, you know, my relationships with the children where, you know, she was always right, you know. But, you know, you get out of that. What I did was, and I don't know if this is the way you would all choose to do this, but I actually taught my children about the temperaments. And I taught it to them through sort of a very earthy, identifying it with the elements, identifying it with plants. And I didn't talk to them about all this science and glandular system ethereal beings and whatnot. But I sort of explained to my daughter and some of my children, I said, people are different types. And, you know, there's the air type, and there's the water type, and there's this type. And, you know, when they were a little bit older, I think I didn't have that discussion until they were seven. You know, but I started with a basic idea that everyone's a different type, and they deal with things in a different way. And just trying to, whatever their level of understanding is, trying to explain that to them, and then also modeling behavior for them. So teaching my poor sanguine child how to deal with the choleric. You know, she wants to be so nice all the time, and she's just such a forgiving, you know, doesn't really take things that seriously child, and so having to deal with her choleric sister is just traumatic. But then me modeling for her how I do it and saying, do this. This is what I do. It works. And then that just transformed her relationship with her sister because she was able to do what I did. So she now talks to her sister in a more assertive way. And she knows to be firm, and she knows to distract her. In fact, she's great at it now. You know, Sophie will just be all, you know, all being bullyish or something about something just bugging people, way, you know, imbalanced, because the temperaments can become imbalanced and just get exaggerated. And she'll get all out of control, and Mosey will sort of sit there and go, okay. And she'll go, Sophie, would you like to play? Would you like to do a puppet show with me right now? And she'll just distract her. And she knows that works now, so she's really good at it. And so you can teach the children by modeling, and if they're a little bit older, you can give them a watered-down version of the temperaments and teach them. So let's see. Oh, that's a good question. When there's two factors here. When you're just beginning to learn about the temperaments, you can't be sure. So I say just work on what you think, and then as you're working with it, it'll become more obvious. So say that you started with a child and you think they're melancholic, and so you work on that, and then you start realizing, oh, I don't really think they're melancholic. This isn't working. Then just switch to the other system and experiment with a few of them. Because if you're confused, you'll probably just be confused between two. You know, I find that you can usually narrow it down to two. No, I haven't found many situations where you look at somebody and go, gosh, I don't know what four of them they are. It's usually which two of them of these, you've usually at least narrowed it down. The second factor is that children don't develop into their temperament in an obvious way until different ages. And so some children, you can define it very quickly when they're 6 months old. I've seen some that are just so obvious. But then also they can change because my choleric child was a phlegmatic baby. And so I thought, cool, you know, I wanted one of these. You know, she was my third child, and I was ready for a phlegmatic child by that time, you know, one that would just sit there and be nice, you know, and calm. And then, so I'm sitting here bragging to all my friends about my phlegmatic baby, and then like 9 months, she turns into this choleric, you know. So anyway, you know, so they change, you know, a lot when they're younger, and it's hard to define them. I'm not sure. I think the age when you really can officially define it is about 7 or 9. But you can define it before that. It's just not as solidly. And especially before they're one, it's hard. Yeah, it's really hard. Another factor is that childhood itself is defined by the sanguine element. So all children are ruled by the sanguine element, no matter what element they are ruled by as a person. And then, let's see, I'm trying to remember that which ages. I think this choleric goes with the childhood then, or the older childhood teenage years. Melancholic goes with the middle age, adult years. And phlegmatic goes with the, the elderly years. I have it in the chart. It must be age. There we go. So the terms they use are childhood, youth, maturity, and old age. And so you'll find that in each age people will change a bit.
So do they change their height? I mean, or
you will change throughout your life. And this is an interesting thing. I can give you an example in my life just to show you how this happens. I'm a sanguine, and as a child, I was in the sanguine element. My childhood was, I was in the air. I mean, I remember my childhood as just being this complete butterfly. All over the place, you know, talking a lot, going all over the place, doing 100 things, you know, just way out of balance, way sanguine, because I was not only sanguine, I was in my sanguine era. And then as a youth, it's very interesting because in my youth years, my teenage years, my choleric element really came up and I started rebelling. I said, I don't want to be this anymore. I'm going to go here. I'm going to leave home when I'm 16 and go travel all over Europe. I'm going to do that. You know, I just had all these. So, you know, combined with my sanguine temperament, all this, you know, choleric element came out. And so I expressed my sanguine temperament in a different way. And then I'm not in old age yet, but in my maturity, I'm in the melancholic. And this is actually the most peaceful age of my life because I have the sanguine temperament, but it's balanced by the melancholy of maturity, and it's wonderful. I feel so peaceful all the time because I have this balance of the melancholy element, which is sort of calming, you know, more cold and dry combined with the hot and damp nature of the sanguine, and the flightiness of the sanguine combined with the deep thoughtfulness of the melancholic. And it's just this wonderful peacefulness. You know, it just combines and helps each other so much. So I don't know what it's going to be like in older age, but you know, you do change. And I can see these elements run through my life.
So it might be hard to nail down. If you're in a transition period in your life, it might be kind of hard to nail down where you're at.
It is easy to define what a person is, even if they're in a different element of their life. For instance, even though I'm able, and because of I'm in the mature age where I've gone through life, and maturity in general brings slow, deep thoughtfulness. That's what maturity is. And so even though maturity has brought me that, my nature is still sanguine. So when I have this mature, deep thoughtfulness, it's an effort for me. It's something that was learned. And that's obvious to people once they get to know me. Because I'll slip, you know? Like I have made it a habit to, instead of reacting quickly to people, I'll wait a few days before I have a conversation that's really intense because I just want to wait. I've learned from age to wait and that some problems will just resolve themselves in a few days. But occasionally my sanguine temperament will come through and go, I want to talk about this right now, you know? And it's not even a big issue, you know? So even though a person may be colored by the age they're in, their temperament comes through pretty obviously in different ways. And it's not a bad thing. You don't want to hide your temperament either. So it'll come through in positive ways, too. So it's pretty easy to define if you start looking at the different things in people and the different natures. I want to go in a little bit to how to work with the temperaments more specifically. And because I think we have 15 minutes left, is it? So I've already touched on this a little bit as I've talked about the temperaments. But I will touch on the first two again briefly, and then the last three I'll talk about, and then I'll ask for some questions. The first one I've already touched on a lot is working with the temperaments. And I've given some examples of how you can work with each temperament, and it was really useful that some people asked questions because that gave me an opportunity to give more examples, like how do you deal with the choleric's willfulness? How do you deal with this or that? So the key here, though, is working with. So just remember that you're working with the temperament. And this was a good question that this lady asked. You know, I don't want to change her temperament. I don't want to force it, do something against it, but I need to know how to deal with it. And that's the key, is you're working with it. Don't try to change your child's temperament. And I have to admit that that's a big temptation sometimes. Because in some temperaments, there's some things like, I'll admit to you my weaknesses with my children. With my melancholic child, I really have to stop myself from just saying, you know, why do you have to be so unenthusiastic about everything we do? You know, I really get upset in myself sometimes. He basically is just dragged along to everything we do. And so that's sort of a touchy point with me, but I have to come to accept that because that's just how he is. And the funny thing is once he comes along, he's so happy to be there. You know, it's just the initial resistance. Like, I would like him to say, oh, yes, Mommy, I'm so glad you planned this for me. But I will never hear that from him. And that makes me a little sad, you know, but I deal with that. And the thing in the choleric child that makes me sad is I just feel like she's so unthankful. And I just have this thing with her sometimes that I have to shut my mouth and just go, you know, don't be negative with her and don't make her think that there's something wrong with her. But just her being ruled by the ego and always thinking about what she wants and being so self-directed and always so energetic that she does one thing and then she's on to the next thing already. And so I'm like, you know, I just want to tell her, Sophie, take some time to reflect on what you just did. Appreciate it. Be thankful. But she's always like, okay, we did that. And I'm like, you know, so I get a little sad. You know, I want her to be more thankful, you know. And so I try to, you know, it is hard even for me knowing all these things about the temperaments, this working with. I keep having to say, no, we're working with. And then, of course, with the sanguine temperament, this is an issue you get into if you have the same temperament as your child. Oh, that is the hardest one, actually, because you know what it's like to go through life as this temperament. And so the tendency with that is for you to want to overprotect and overteach the child how to deal with their temperament. And so me, I'm always having to stop myself with my sanguine child. I want to always tell her, oh, you know what? I know that if you keep doing this, your life is just going to be so hard for you, so why don't you just do it this way? And I want to teach her everything now. You know, all those hard lessons I had to learn as a sanguine, I want to teach them all to her now. And, you know, you'll want to do that, you know, because if you have a child of, you know, that temperament. So it's really a challenge. You know, you'll have this resistance in yourself. You'll either want to work with the temperament so much and really work with it a lot because it's similar, or you'll want to work against it because it's dissimilar to you. And you just have to keep repeating, work with in a gentle way. Let it unfold. And then acceptance. And that's what I was talking about before, where I have a hard time accepting some things in each of the temperaments. But you have to accept it, because that's how it is. And if you look at it logically, if that's how it is, why would you not accept it? Because what's the point in trying to not accept it, or go against it, or change it, or try, because you know you're not going to be able to? What would be the point? And then if you look at it that way, you think, oh, well, yeah, then why am I just not accepting it? Because that's the best option. There's really no other option. It's sort of like, say that you were trying to break down a wall and you just kept hitting at it and hitting at it. What's next? I gave you the chart that defined cold, damp, dry, and hot. Because the melancholic is defined by the cold and dry elements. The choleric is hot and dry like fire. The sanguine is damp and hot, like, I guess, the air. And the phlegmatic is damp and cold like water, the water element. And this is what defines them. And so to balance these temperaments, you can use foods and herbs and activities that will balance them. And to balance, you want to use the opposite element. And you use the... and. I'm talking about to balance an exaggerated temperament. So if the temperament is exaggerated, like they're just so willful, they're so angry as a choleric, or they're just so out there as a sanguine, they're so depressed as a melancholic, you know, just the extreme of the temperament, if you get an extreme temperament, you can balance it by using opposite foods and herbs. And so say that you have a choleric child and they're having a lot of anger issues, just a lot of just maybe too much energy, just too much anxiety about things, and they are of the dry and hot element. If you can feed them more foods that are cool and damp, or herbs that have a cool and damp quality, you can balance that fire element in them and bring it more to a balance instead of an exaggerated state. And the chart that I have actually has all the foods and herbs listed, and then on the side it tells what qualities they are. But in general, you can figure it out for yourself without a chart. Because if you think of different foods, just let's pick out a food like fruit. Is fruit dry or damp? Damp. That was an obvious one. Is it cold or hot? It's cold. So see, you already know. And pretty much 80% of the food we eat, you can figure out like that. Like cinnamon. as a spice? Is cinnamon hot or cold? It's hot. And is it dry or damp? Mm-hmm. Good, you guys are good. And so, because some people didn't get that in the cinnamon. And that's another thing, is if you can just get one thing, it's okay. Just work with that. If you know that the food is damp or it's hot and you can't figure out the other aspect, just work with that one. Do the best you can. And so you can use food and herbs for their qualities. Use the opposite quality to balance the temperament. And if you make a little short chart, which I maybe should have put on here, but I'll just sort of go from top to bottom. In general, fruits and vegetables are cooling, and cheeses and yogurts and things that are made out of milk are cooling, but not milk itself, that's actually heating. Goat's milk, sheep's milk, things like that are cooling. Grains are all neutral, and most meat is actually heating, although lamb and turkey are cooling, and fish is cooling. And then cow's milk is heating, and spicy foods are heating. So that's sort of a general guideline, although there's some specifics and exceptions in there. And then as far as activities, you can actually enroll your children in activities or guide them towards certain activities, or you can choose certain activities in your life that are based on hot and cold that will balance the temperaments. And so, for instance, if you want to balance a sanguine or choleric temperament, you can do activities that are cooler. And if you want to balance a phlegmatic or melancholic temperament, you can do activities that are more hot. And once again, sort of making a chart on a scale from 1 to 10 or whatever, at the bottom of the chart, the most cooling activity, can anyone guess? Sleep. Sleep. Most cooling activity is sleep. And somebody said something about swimming. Swimming, that, just sitting around in the water and relaxing, as long as it's not a hot tub, that can be cooling. But if it's in a hot tub, that would be heating. And if it's swimming as a sport, that would also be heating, because vigorous sports are all heating. Another thing that's cooling is just to sit around and have tea with someone or have a gentle conversation. Something else that's cooling is yoga or meditation. Things that are hot on the top of the scale, arguing is hot. And this is a little example I give people. Say that your husband comes home from work, or your wife comes home from, you know, some play date or some work, or I don't know, people are coming home and they're meeting each other. Okay, the person, your spouse comes home and they meet you, and they are just mad about something. They're in a bad mood, they're angry, they're anxious, they're filled with choler. Well, you can do two things to balance this. Don't fill them with hot activities. Don't ask them to go do something right away that involves activity, like, okay, let's go play tennis right now or something. Don't have a conversation with them that's heated, like an angry conversation or one that involves a lot of mental activity. Like, don't start telling them about your day. Don't give them spicy food right away, or like cinnamon tea, or you know, something that's spicy. You can work with that. Balance it by offering them some peppermint tea, inviting them to sit. And TV, by the way, is a heating activity. So if you're watching TV, you're just making the heat rise. And sugar is very heating, too. And this is interesting because a lot of people will write these big, long articles on why TV is harmful and why sugar is harmful and why it causes all this agitation in people. And they're all correct. They've all defined it in different ways. But you can also define it temperamentally. TV's hot, sugar's hot. Of course, it's going to cause a rise in anxiety and anger and activity in people. So that pretty much gives you an idea of a general idea of how to balance with foods and activities. And I'll send you the chart by email. And does anyone have any questions?
You should end, so people
can evaluate. So we'll end. I know some people have to catch planes too. So.